Welcome, Alan.
Thank you, everyone. So I want you to imagine that today you were at the Tropic of Capricorn, where it passes through Kruger National Park in South Africa at exactly 12:02 p.m. South Africa time, which was 2:02 a.m. our time. Besides all the amazing animals, you would have seen the sun reach its southernmost point, and for a brief second, it stops directly overhead and seemingly turns back northward. You would have witnessed the solstice, what we call the winter solstice and they call the summer solstice. And scientifically speaking, the solstice is just that moment of change, that stop and go back. So commonly we claim the whole day is the solstice, and in the Northern Hemisphere, some celebrate it as the longest period of darkness and others as the return of light. So that's the paradox. An event happens and two different observers in two different points claim it and call it their own. And then you add 8 billion other people in the world at 8 billion other observation points. And now 8 billion people claim this experience, that they know this experience. And what are they claiming? The longest day, the shortest day? For folks on the equator, the day doesn't change at all. It's the same length. But as a scientifically verifiable event, we think that someone must be right in this. So can anyone really tell us that they have seen or experienced the shortest or longest day? I mean, the sun isn't really doing anything by itself that it doesn't do all the time. The sun doesn't know that on Earth these things are happening. The sun is just being the sun. Yet, in a way, we believe that the sun really stops its movement in the sky. Are we making this all up? What's going on here? And I'm not trying to debunk the scientific explanation and accuracy of this very observable phenomenon, and nor am I trying to ignore that the human race has a long history of marking the solstice, starting with the Neolithic structures in places such as the 5,200-year-old temple in Newgrange, Ireland, where this morning I tuned in to see the solstice, only because it's Ireland, of course, the sun didn't come out today. So we were told that the solstice happened without a sun, which makes it again, it's like, is it a solstice without the sun? If you can't see the sun, is it really happening? And I'm curious, really, I'm bringing this up, so I'm curious about how we think about things we know from our relative perspective, and that we act in belief that our knowledge is shared by all. So the solstice is just one thing that we experience, we think we know it is, what it is, and then we think everyone thinks the same that we do about it. So Ehe Dogen, the person who brought Zen to Japan in the 1200s, addressed this question in his greatest work called the Genjo Koan. And in the chat, actually, I'll just do it right as I'm saying here. I have a link to the things that I mentioned in here with Dogen and other things. So this is what Dogen said. If one riding in a boat watches the coast, one mistakenly perceives the coast as moving. If one watches the boat in relation to the surface of the water, then one notices the boat is moving. This is the cone of our solstice. What are we looking at? What do we bring to this act of observation and interpretation? What is it that we think we are observing and experience? The most general understanding of the word koan is that it's an enigmatic Zen teaching story. Shiwaku Okamura Roshi, whose translation of the Genjo Koan I just quoted, is right now one of the foremost living Zen scholars, especially of Dogen. He translates the word koan as absolute truth that embraces relative truth, or you can say a question that true reality asks of us. For Dogen and Okamura, absolute truth is our interconnectedness and relative truth is our individuality. This deeper dive into the word koan helps us better understand their purpose, particularly in the Rinzai Zen tradition. Koans are a specific tool to understand the connection between interbeing and our individual sense of awareness. So last week, Stephen Turney talked about paradoxes in Zen using this text for the Sandokai, the harmony of difference and equality. Looking at the solstice as a teaching koan, can we hold our notion of the solstice, a relative individual truth, at the same time we hold the absolute truth or universal truth that we have nothing to hold on to or we can't hold on to anything? So Okamura points out that Dogen in particular love these sorts of paradoxes for their effect on the mind. Buddhist teachers often refer to the mind rather than our mind to signify the mind is not owned by each one of us individually. But our mind is the biggest block against accepting and experiencing what we call absolute reality, interconnectedness, interbeing, perhaps enlightenment. The mind wants us to believe that the individual is the most important and nothing else exists. And we know as practitioners, our practice is to realize that the absolute and this relative coexist together within each other. Hundreds of thousands of words have been written about understanding this, and Dogen excelled in using one method for obliterating the mind's hold over us. In his teaching, Okamura Roshi suggests that Dogen uses paradoxes to try to force our mind to give up its attempt to reconcile the unreconcilable. If we let the ideas clash, if we breathe and sit, we experience what it means to have the absolute and relative truths coexist as a unified, interconnected whole. When he talked about this in a recent retreat that I attended of his, a light went on for me. The light was, stop trying to understand and feel. Of all of Dogen's writings, I think the Genjo Koan is considered the text from what everything flows in Soto Zen. Written in 1233 and translated into English a number of times, the Genjo Koan is only about 13 paragraphs long. And Okamura translates the title of the Genjo Koan as, to answer the question from true reality, which would be enlightened, interconnected reality, through the practice of our everyday activity, through our relative reality. So we're trying to answer this big question of what is this thing that's interconnectedness? And the way we do it is by our everyday activity. So you can't get rid of everyday activities and you can't get rid of the interconnectedness. You have to hold them both. Here, true reality is interconnectedness of all beings and phenomena, and everyday activity is the relative way we live our lives. So as we ponder the solstice and try to wrap our minds around it, I want to share some words from paragraph 9 of the Genjo Koan. I consider this as the particular section that is some of the most beautiful poetry that Dogen wrote. So before I read the short section, let's prepare our bodies and mind to take in the words as Okamura suggests we should. So please take a few deep breaths in and out and settle into your body. As you focus on the breath, imagine that it's not your breath, but the shared breath of all beings. As I read the words of the poem, I would suggest to you to imagine hearing and feeling the words in your body, in your chest and belly, in your arms and legs, in your shoulders and throat, through the floor, through the walls, through the ceiling. As Dogen says in the Buddha Sutra, receive and emit the sutras through our nostrils and receive and emit them through the tips of our toes. Hear the words with your eyes, feel them with your lips and tongue, and smell them with your ears. Let your brain take a deserved vacation. So this is what Dogen wrote. When a person attains realization, it is like the moon's reflection in water. The moon never becomes wet, yet the water is never disturbed. Although the moon is vast in great light, it's reflected in a drop of water. The whole moon and even the whole sky are reflected in a drop of dew on a blade of grass. Realization does not destroy the person as the sun and moon, as the moon, and even the whole sky does not make a hole in water. The person does not obstruct realization as a drop of dew does not obstruct the moon in the sky. The depth is the same as the height. I'm going to repeat that again. There's a lot there. And again, just feel it and let whatever images come up, just come up with you. When a person attains realization, it is like the moon's reflection in water. The moon never gets wet. The water is never disturbed. Although the moon is vast and great light, it is reflected in a drop of water. The whole moon and even the whole sky are reflected in a drop of dew on a blade of grass. Realization does not destroy the person, as the moon and even the whole sky does not make a hole in the water. The person does not obstruct realization, as a drop of dew does not obstruct the moon in the sky. The depth is the same as the height. When I first read these words several years ago, my breath became very deep. My mind quieted as I was completely transfixed. I think when I did this, I stayed on this paragraph for minutes or hours. I don't even know. It was one of those experiences. I just couldn't find any reason to move on and to read another word. My entire body was enveloped in the moonlight, the dewdrop, and the inclusiveness of the universe. So in this paragraph, Dogen does a wonderful thing. He takes a paradox that we can understand and visualize: the moon, its reflection in the water. We think we know that. And through experience, we intuitively understand the difference between the moon as an entity and its reflection, the water as an entity and its ability to reflect, the grass as an entity, its ability to hold a drop of water reflecting the moon. The objects, again, using Dogen's words and Okamura's words, are relative truths, things we can sense with our sense organs. And in this case, the reflection is the absolute truth of interbeing and interconnectedness of all objects and beings. Both realms exist within each other. He then makes the jump to ourselves as humans when he says realization, or to use another word, enlightenment, does not destroy the person. He is telling us that enlightenment, or absolute truth, contains the relative nature of the reality we perceive. He goes on to say that the person living in their individual lives with their habits, thoughts, and decisions, reacting to and in a particular environment and time and place, does not prevent one from experiencing realization, enlightenment, or oneness. This is the core of Dogen's teaching. Much of the rest of all the writings he has written are about practice, living with this teaching in our lives. So in the future, when you come across a confusing and paradoxical Buddhist text or koan, or even a poem, try to do it in this way that we experience today. Explore the words with your body and breath. Linger and luxuriate in image, smell, sound, and sight. This is how we are meant to experience the Dharma. Our shelter in place offers us unlimited opportunities to explore Dogen's verse. On a daily basis, spend some time in the special Dharma space, seeing the world in a blossom, listening to the song of the wind, smelling the aromas of faraway places in your cup of tea, letting the story of the cold in the night coming from polar reaches chill your bones, feeling the rumblings of the earth, whether it is from music blasting from a car squealing down the street or the shifting of tectonic plates. We are never separated from this absolute reality. For the past 13 years, a group of us has met at the AIDS Memorial Grove today on the solstice to remember our beloved friend, Deborah Kent, who died on the solstice 13 years ago. Today, this gathering happened on Zoom just before a Sangha meeting, and our time together was deepened by the recent death of Pat Dunn, a member of our circle and likely a friend of others in our Sangha. Thus, the solstice for me has been transformed as a time of remembrance of an AIDS warrior who left us too soon, but made sure her daughter and my goddaughter, Sophie, was in good hands before she died. Many a gathering around the boulder in the AIDS Grove, emblazoned with her name and the words generous, compassionate, tenacious, full of life, mother, you are in our hearts forever, were marked by tears and laughter in the late afternoon as the sun set and the damp coolness of the groves descended around us. For a few moments, Deborah was there with us in our memories, in our stories, amazed that we were still there, amazed that we came back every year, amazed that we continue to honor her. The leaves on the trees, yellow and brown, would fall silently as our witnesses to the cycle of life and death, of love and loss, of dark and light. What started in the last rays of the day ended in the darkness of the evening, which shrouded the trees and rocks and path that were so clear when we arrived. A chill would settle in, and despite our down coats and hats, our noses would get cold, and we'd all began to rock back and forth to keep ourselves warm. Our time with our memories would pass, yet the surroundings held us. Even in the dark, our hearts beat stronger, warmed by the love of life within the existence of suffering and death. The next day we knew would be longer and somehow brighter. It was the end and the beginning. The Genjo Koan of our existence, answering the question from true reality through the practice of our everyday activity. So thank you. We have a little bit of time for any questions or comments or any of your experiences. Loki.
That's such a beautiful teaching. Thank you. And I ponder this absolute versus relative all the time, and you just made it clearer and bringing it. I didn't know about this koan. So thank you. I just felt like I've been parched for this aspect of the Dharma, and it just rained and filled the cup of my heart. So thank you. And I've heard the words conditioned and the unconditioned. Would that correlate to the ultimate and the relative in terms of the two truths, the conditioned and the unconditioned, or something about the deathless? I'm just remembering other teachings.
I think there's lots of ways of talking about it. And anything about conditioned means our real life. You know, because there's all these conditions that are there that we experience and then we interpret. And in the kind of the absolute, when we touch kind of the greater interconnectedness, there are no conditions. So that's another way of doing it. I think the only thing I'll add to what you said is you posed it, which is the way we typically pose it, as a versus. It's like absolute versus relative. And Dogen is like super duper clear on this. It's like there. It's like you can't even say both, because saying both makes it separate. And so it's just that they're within each other. They work within each other. They're all part of each other. So the relative is in the absolute. The absolute's in the relative. Our individual activity again is in enlightenment, and enlightenment directs our individual activity. So when we think it, and that's why Dogen does these paradoxes, is to like get our mind to say, oh, stop, you know, stop doing that, and just accept that, accept it, just accept it. And you know, and that's what practice is all about, giving us a space and time and the meditation and a place to like let our brains do that, and let our body actually let our brains go to sleep and let our body accept those. So thanks. Lynn, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I had my hand up. I'm Lynn. I was wondering if there's any females in poetry, you know, any Zen poetry from 1120 AD that was written by women, or is it all men from that
time? Well, there's definitely female Buddhist poetry, and the and actually give me one second here, because I can pull up a very quick one, the one I love the most, because I'm actually I'm writing a new novel that's based on the Genjo Koan in a way. But so this was a poem written by Puna, who was one of the earliest female disciples of Buddha. And it says, "Fill yourself with the Dharma. When you're as full as the full moon, burst open, make the dark night shine." So that's what I can give you from our female ancestors today. Tony, was that a raised hand? No, okay.
No, it was just a thumbs up. I like the poem, so.
Yeah, there's a book. It came from a book, which I don't have in front of me, that are the poems of the female ancestors. And so I would check that out. It's a small volume. It came out last year, I believe.
What's the name of the author again?
Well, this particular poem was by Puna, but I don't have, there's a book. And
P-U-N-A?
P-U, yeah, or N-N-A, one of the two, yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Hi, Alan. This is an aside, but I was just trying to click on the link that you sent us, and it's prompting me to log into WordPress. So I think that might not be the right link.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Let me double. Yeah, I will double. While we do the end stuff, I will double check to see. Oh, I see what happened. Yeah.
Thank you.
I had the wrong version in there. Okay. All right. I will fix that before the end. Any other questions, thoughts?
I can ask you a question, Alan, that I haven't thought about this a lot, but I had heard a recent teaching about the role of clinging in experience of the conditioned and the unconditioned, the deathless, or the, what is the deathless? What's the opposite of the deathless? The death? I don't know. Yeah. The absolute and the relative, and that.
I think it's the lifeless.
The lifeless. All right. So, have you thought about, has that been part of what you've been, you know, studying or thinking about yourself with respect to the relative and the absolute?
Well, I think the clinging comes in in terms of the individual into the relative, you know, like, these are my ideas. They have to be right. And that they guide me, and, you know, they guide me. So, and yes, an understanding of how the solstice work does guide me. I mean, I don't want to deny science, and, but then when presented with new information, am I willing to deal with that new information? Or do I just say, no, don't tell me anything more. I have my fixed view. So I think clinging is really our individual and our mind, like, controlling what comes in and what comes out. And it's not a matter that we never, because we will cling, and we have to cling to, like, I have to cling to remember to floss my teeth every night. You know, I have to do that. Like, that's how I remember to floss my teeth. So it's not a bad thing. But that other aspects of our life, clinging to that we'll never die or get sick, grow old, that's not going to work for that one. So clinging works for floss. It doesn't work for dying and getting old. So I think that's, I'm being a little bit simplistic, but that's the way to, it's going to be there. And sometimes it's a good thing. And sometimes, it's not. Thanks.
Alan, thank you very much for that great talk.